everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Thank you all for tuning in once again. We have to give a big thank you to our listener, Danielle, for requesting today's case. We also want to let you know that we have to take next week off. So there won't be an episode on April 28th, but we will be back on May 5th.
And if you're enjoying this podcast, give us a review. You know, we love to get feedback on how we're doing, what you want to hear, what you don't like hearing.
Yes, we got a really nice one from someone in Germany recently. So appreciate that review. I just saw it recently. And we do read them. We really appreciate when people write in.
Yeah. And if you're wanting to hear a case, you've heard about a case and you haven't seen much coverage on it, please email us at keytothecase@gmail.com, or you can message us via Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast.
All right, let's discuss today's case. Alicia Hummel was 29 years old at the time of her murder in 2015. Alicia was born in Sioux City, Iowa, located in northwest Iowa near the border of Nebraska as well as South Dakota. Alicia and one of her sisters, Erica, were primarily raised by their grandparents. Alicia's inquisitive nature was apparent from a young age. She was smart and she definitely loved to learn. Alicia was deeply loyal and she was always there for her friends, even when maybe she needed them to be there more for her. Alicia was a bright student, and in high school, she was introduced to a young man named Tony, and they started a relationship which they maintained after high school graduation in 2004. After high school, Alicia enrolled in South Dakota State University, which sits just about 140 miles or 225 kilometers away from Sioux City in Iowa. Alicia planned to become a nurse, but by her junior year, she decided that was no longer the path she wanted to take. At that point, she enlisted in the military to help pay for education, but she was medically discharged before she could complete basic training due to a knee injury she sustained. Alicia pivoted, and in 2009, she earned a bachelor's degree in human development and family studies. And then in 2011, Alicia and Tony married, and then she continued her education by earning another bachelor's degree in 2012 in communication disorders from a different university, the University of South Dakota, located in Vermilion.
So did she have a plan in mind for what she wanted to do after she got all these degrees?
Yes. And you can kind of see this love for learning she had. It definitely extended well beyond childhood. She wanted to get into early childhood development, which is what she ultimately did. She did consider a master's degree, but she was really eager to join the workforce. So she got a job working for Siouxland Family Center in Dakota City, Nebraska. And Dakota City is very close to Sioux City. Alicia taught preschool, and she was passionate about her career. She loved working with children and their families, and she was exceptionally skilled at it too. She was in the type of role where she looked forward to going to work each day, which I think is a goal for most people.
So Alicia is obviously very passionate about working with children. So did she want to start a family of her own with Tony?
I know Alicia wanted to have kids at some point. She never had kids before her murder, but she wanted to start a family one day. I couldn't tell you about Tony, but I know that was something Alicia looked forward to in her future. Getting a master's degree was still an option for Alicia. It's quite likely, actually, that at some point she would have gone back to school if she had gotten the opportunity. After graduation, she and Tony moved to a small town in Nebraska called Newcastle. While Alicia's work life was flourishing, her marriage with Tony was going south. There was an imbalance in their relationship, and Alicia felt more invested in it than Tony. Tony grew distant, and sadly, she learned that he was having an affair. Alicia tried to mend the marriage. She really did. She did not just give up when she found out Tony was having an affair, but Tony seemed to have moved on, so they separated in 2014, and Alicia moved back in with her grandparents. This was a difficult time for Alicia, but her friends explained that as the divorce got closer and closer, Alicia was beginning to accept the situation more, and her friends describe that she's starting to find herself again. She was supposed to file for divorce just a few days after her death. Monday, June 1st, 2015 was an exciting day for Alicia. Sources kind of vary on this. Most sources say it was the first day of summer vacation and that she had about a month off from work. Others say that she was in between jobs. She was starting a new job, so she had a month off between jobs. Either way, she had a month off from work and she was excited and she wanted to kick off the break by doing something she enjoyed. Alicia loved the outdoors, so she decided to go fishing that day. She asked a few of her friends if they wanted to join her, but when they were unable to, that didn't stop her. Alicia was spontaneous and independent. She had no problem doing things by herself. Additionally, her grandmother said, quote, "No fear. That's the one thing I always worried about. She just didn't seem to fear things," end quote. Alicia planned to go to Myron Grove, a state recreation area near Vermilion, South Dakota, located about a 40-minute drive away from Sioux City, where she lived. Alicia could fish in a remote area along the Missouri River at Myron Grove, and it was a spot that Alicia had been fishing before. I suspect since she went to college in Vermilion, where she earned her second bachelor's degree, she familiarized herself with the best fishing spots in that area. One of Alicia's friends described it as a beautiful place.
So this spot she went fishing at, was it pretty secluded or was it a pretty popular fishing spot?
It was pretty popular, which was a little surprising to me because when you look at it on a map, it looks very secluded and it is. It's more of a remote area, more of a rural area. There are some properties nearby, but it is kind of on its own. So I was surprised to learn that it actually is a pretty popular spot to go fishing.
Okay, so it's both. It's both yeah. A secluded spot, but also an area where people flock to go fish.
Right, they're not mutually exclusive. Like it is a popular spot, but it's also in a secluded area, exactly. Before departing her home, Alicia asked her grandfather if he would help her clean any fish she caught, and once he agreed, she went on her way. Little did they know, that would be the last time they saw Alicia. Alicia was pretty active on social media. Some even described her as being glued or attached to her phone, which is actually rather helpful in this case, but she especially loved sharing her life through photos on various social media platforms like Facebook and Snapchat. The day before the fishing excursion, she posted on Facebook that she wanted to go fishing. Then on June 1st, Alicia posted on Facebook saying, "First day of vacay, I'm going fishing." After Alicia left her grandparents' home, she began documenting her day through both Snapchat and text. Now, I believe most of her Snapchats were posted to her Snapchat story, which would have been available for all of her Snapchat friends to view for 24 hours, unless, of course, she blocked someone or deleted one of her posts. The first Snapchat was a picture from inside her car at 11:53 a.m. when she said, "When your pole doesn't fit in your car," and her fishing pole was sticking out of the sunroof of her gray Ford Fusion. As she drove into South Dakota, she posted another Snapchat from the road. From there, she sent a text just before 1 p.m. indicating that she couldn't find her tackle box, so she was starting over. Alicia sent another text 15 minutes later at 1:06 p.m. saying she stopped at Walmart in Vermilion to purchase a fishing license. After she left Walmart at 1:19 p.m., she sent another text stating that the man working at Walmart who issued her fishing license told her he hoped she caught a big one. It took Alicia roughly 10 minutes to go from Walmart to Myron Grove, and once she arrived, she posted a picture on Snapchat at 1:30 p.m. of the Myron Grove view, and she said, "Finally, I've been waiting since fall." Not long after that, around 1:45 p.m., Alicia texted a friend saying, "Apparently it's a nice day to get it on in the car, midday too, LMAO." Somewhat eerily, that was the last text Alicia would ever send and the last communication from her phone at all on an otherwise very active and communicative day. I thought to myself, that must have been a little awkward because the pull-in or the parking area is somewhat small. So as Alicia got her stuff out and got ready to fish, she was likely in open view of the people who were inside this car. And we'll discuss this more later, but most likely no one else was around. So it was just her and the people in this vehicle.
Yeah, this just must have been so awkward for Alicia. Like, you see these people having sex in a car and you're like, well, I guess I'm going to go fish. Like, if they're the only other people there, it's like, well, okay.
Yeah, super awkward. And I will say, once she walked down to begin fishing, she would have been away from that situation a little bit. But I just thought the whole situation was strange. And yeah, it also makes you wonder about just the situation for these people to be available to do this in the middle of the afternoon on a Monday. I guess all it really tells us is that they don't work a 9-to-5 type of job, or they were off from work that day. A short while later, a state park boat ramp attendant, whose job was to tend to the ramps, came upon Alicia's body. At approximately 2:15 p.m., so about 30 minutes after she last sent that text, the attendant discovered Alicia's body, and he found her near the shore at the boat dock at Myron Grove, the same dock that was in the photo she posted to Snapchat. Her cause of death was not immediately apparent.
So obviously no blunt trauma or, you know, gunshot wounds or stab wounds, anything like that.
Well,
obviously, right?
I'll give you more details on how she died, but I'm just saying immediately it was not obvious how she died. And she was in the water, so that's a component too, which may have made it harder to tell. Alicia's car was still parked where she presumably parked when she arrived. Her car keys were sitting in the front passenger seat and her window was rolled down. Meanwhile, Alicia's family and friends, who were unaware of what happened to her, were growing concerned. Alicia was so responsive and active on social media. So for no one to hear from her for hours and for texts to go without a response, this was more alarming than it might be for someone who isn't that way. When her grandma texted her to see if she'd be home for dinner and she got no response, she began to wonder if maybe Alicia dropped her phone in the river, because she could be clumsy at times.
So do you know if her phone was on her when she was found in the river? Because I'm wondering if when someone tried to call her and it went straight to voicemail, then that would have been a pretty telltale sign of her phone being dead.
Yeah, so Alicia's phone was not on her body or in a pocket at all when she was found. And the phone was evidently not immediately found. We will get back to the phone, but just to answer your question, her phone was not on her. Alicia's family's worries got the best of them, and Alicia was reported as a missing person at 5:20 p.m.
Wow, that's pretty quick. That's right around 4 hours, right?
It is.
Since her last communication around 119, I think is what you said.
130.
Okay. Yeah, 130 for her last Snapchat.
The last Snapchat was at 130 and the last text was at 145.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, less than 4 hours.
Right. But I think that's a testament to how easy it was to communicate with Alicia normally through text,
right,
or through Snapchat. So I think because they weren't hearing back from her and because she was normally so quick to respond, that's what caused them to report her missing. And they had no reason to believe that she would be gone so long. I think they thought she would be gone for a fairly short period and then she would make it back and have dinner with them. So at 5:20 p.m., they were deeply concerned about her well-being. But about 5 hours after that, Alicia's family received the devastating news of her death from the Clay County Sheriff's Department. The autopsy was performed the day after Alicia's death, and the results revealed that Alicia's manner of death was homicide. Her cause of death was drowning, with contributing circumstances of an incised wound on her neck and blunt force injuries to the head. Clay County Sheriff Andy Howe put it best. He said, quote, "It was obvious that there was an assault, although the injuries from her assault didn't cause her death. Although I'm certain that they may have contributed to the drowning," end quote.
So the cause of her death was drowning, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I take that as meaning that had Alicia been assaulted and left out of the water, she likely would have survived. We don't know if Alicia's killer forcefully held her underwater or if they assaulted her, then just placed her in the water and she didn't have the energy to try to survive and her injuries just kind of made it difficult to swim back to shore. But either scenario is possible. Alicia had bruising on her arms and hands and a broken finger that her family saw at her funeral, likely indicating that she fought her attacker during the murder. Law enforcement determined that a struggle likely occurred on the riverbank. Overall, Alicia's murder has been described as a very violent event. The sheriff's department knows what weapon was used, or at least what type of weapon was used during the beating, but they've chosen not to reveal what that weapon was, rightfully so.
So maybe I'm being a little naive. Why can't they release that information? I feel like that may be a little helpful. I mean, unless it is some sort of generic sort of weapon, but I'm just curious why they couldn't release that to the public.
Yeah, so that's something only the killer would know. So I think they're trying to hold back a lot of information like that in this case where, and you'll see it as we continue on, they're holding back certain pieces of information that only the killer would know so that if one day they get a confession from someone, hopefully one day someone confesses to this murder, that person can bring forth unique information, information that was not released to the public. But regarding the injury to the neck, I did not get the impression that they know what caused that injury to her neck or what was used to cut her neck. That leads me to believe that the object used to strike Alicia's head was either left at the scene or the injuries made it clear what the object was. But the same cannot be said of the neck wound. Law enforcement has never commented on whether Alicia was a victim of sexual assault. And the toxicology report that was completed showed no sign of controlled substances or alcohol in Alicia's system. With Alicia's death ruled as a homicide, the sheriff's department began investigating, but they needed help from the public. Anyone who was at Myron Grove that day or in the general area might be able to provide valuable information. Authorities learned rather quickly that there was a dark-colored sedan with tinted windows and a loud exhaust system seen in the area around the time Alicia was there by multiple witnesses. No one could specify a make or model of the sedan. We also don't know the make or model or even the color of the car Alicia saw with the people inside, apparently having sex. She did not share what kind of car it was with her friend she was texting, or even if the people were in a sedan. And why would she? I mean, that would just be kind of a random detail to share. Law enforcement requested anyone who may have seen this vehicle or anyone believed to match this description or anyone who thought they knew the driver of the vehicle to come forward. Initially, I thought that's a super vague description. A dark-colored sedan with tinted windows and a loud exhaust. The loud exhaust helps a little bit, and it is vague. But what if there was someone out there who knew someone who drove a car like this, who they knew frequented Myron Grove, and they were unaccounted for during that time? Well, that doesn't make them guilty, but it would be worth looking into. So I don't think this description of the vehicle is useless. Several pieces of evidence were collected from the scene for testing at the state crime lab. The area was canvassed for some of Alicia's missing belongings. And in the meantime, investigators began looking into tips from the public, as well as conducting interviews with the people close to Alicia and reviewing her cell phone records. Initial reports indicated that Alicia's cell phone and fishing pole had yet to be found. Alicia's soon-to-be ex-husband, Tony, was questioned. However, he was quickly ruled out because he had a solid alibi. He was in Pierre, South Dakota, located 255 miles away from where Alicia was, or about a four-hour drive. Tony was with other people who could corroborate this. Tony has been rather quiet in regard to Alicia's murder. He has every right to be publicly quiet, and there's no reason to believe he wanted to harm Alicia. He had already moved on to another relationship, although it's unclear if the woman he was seeing when Alicia was murdered was the same woman he had an affair with. And at some point after Alicia's murder, he moved out of state. The woman that he was in a relationship with at the time of Alicia's murder was questioned as well, and she was described as cooperative. Normally, an ex of a victim, especially an ex when there's divorce coming up in 2 to 3 days and there was a previous affair, is a rather obvious suspect. But in this case, the circumstances do not align in a way that Tony could have been responsible. The state boat ramp attendant who found Alicia's body was subjected to a lot of questioning. He was completely cooperative, and they found no evidence to support that he was lying or that he had anything to do with Alicia's murder. Alarmingly, just 9 days into the investigation on June 10th, Sheriff Andy Howe reported that leads were dwindling. This is certainly not what you want to hear so early on in an investigation. As results from forensic testing started to come back, Sheriff Howe stated that he couldn't share if the results pointed in a certain direction, although it was apparent through my research that there was physical evidence left behind at the scene and that law enforcement likely has DNA evidence that could be used in this case. Although they've been pretty cagey about answering that question, they've said enough to where it's relatively clear that there is at least some DNA evidence that could be used. Several months later, Sheriff Howe shared that they hadn't identified a suspect yet, but that they were looking at several people very closely as potential suspects. He described the case as having a lot of data that they needed to put together. They were still trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
How did they find these suspects?
I know at least some of these people were identified from tips that came in. So tips came in from people who thought they knew someone who drove the vehicle or drove a vehicle matching the description of the one seen at Myron Grove. So those were some of the people in the pool. I at least know that. Throughout the course of the investigation, no one has come forward to say they were at Myron Grove that day or that they saw Alicia. And there were no people or cars seen in that photo Alicia shared to Snapchat while she was there. But then again, the photo was also facing the water, so you wouldn't really expect to see any cars or people. So the people Alicia saw in the vehicle have never revealed themselves. And if anyone else was there that day, even hours earlier, they have stayed silent as well. But it's very possible that no one was there that Monday afternoon besides Alicia and the people in the car. And it raises a few questions. Why did the people Alicia saw not come forward? Were they responsible for her murder? Were they doing something they shouldn't have been and didn't want to expose themselves because of that? Or did they not hear the news? If they did hear the news, they may or may not have been surprised to learn that Alicia sent that text to her friend about them. The state park employee who found Alicia, as well as a nearby resident, were the ones who saw the dark-colored sedan. There's one road to get in and out of Myron Grove, and it forks shortly before the dock, with one road taking you to private properties and the other taking you right to where Alicia went. Law enforcement has confirmed that this vehicle was seen on the sole road that goes to and from Myron Grove, so there's reason to believe the person driving the vehicle at the very least was a witness to the crime. It is a more remote area, an isolated location, which doesn't help the case by any means, but because there are properties or homes nearby, with some sitting right along the Missouri River, one property being very close to where Alicia would have been fishing, it could have been any of those homeowners who saw the vehicle, but because of the thick brush surrounding the dock area in the summertime, Alicia or anyone else for that matter would not have been very visible to people driving in the area. Sheriff Howe expressed shock that more people weren't there that day because he described it as a popular area for locals, so it should have been busy. He said traffic goes in and out of that area all the time, so we're kind of hitting on the point we made earlier that this is an isolated area, but it's also a fairly popular area for fishing, especially in the summertime. After Alicia's murder, law enforcement equipped the Myron Grove area with surveillance cameras to potentially capture suspicious activity or even capture the killer revisiting the crime scene, but evidently nothing ever came of that. A year after Alicia's murder, a few local college students discovered her purse on an above-water sandbar located downstream from where Alicia was discovered, and the purse had cash, credit cards, and other personal items still intact inside, with the exception of her cell phone. I find the purse to be interesting because you'd think Alicia may have left it in the car, but maybe it was on her body when she was killed and it just floated to where it ended up. Otherwise, this means the killer disposed of it at the time of the murder.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it wasn't a robbery, right? Because her cash and her credit cards were still in the purse.
Yes, exactly. So at least we have one motive ruled out. We don't know about other motives, but at least we know it most likely was not a robbery that then turned into a murder. In 2021, 6 years after Alicia's murder, Sheriff Howe told Killaland News that there were people who had not been ruled out and that they had suspects, but they didn't have a case. When asked if the manner in which Alicia died, you know, the violence of it, was a sign that the killer knew Alicia or that it was a personal crime, Sheriff Howe said they had no information to support that this was anything other than a random crime or a crime of opportunity. They have no evidence to place anyone close to Alicia or anyone in Alicia's life at the crime scene. Alicia's friends struggle with the idea that this could be a random crime. Her close friend Bethany explained it in an interesting way. She more or less said it was as if the person killed Alicia in three different ways: the beating, the neck wound, and the drowning. Now, we know the drowning was the effective cause of death, but I can see how the combination of injuries can make this appear like a personal crime, like someone who's really angry with Alicia. Also in the 2021 segment from Killaland News, Alicia's grandmother revealed that there was a pair of men's shoes found at the scene. The investigator who spoke with her described the shoes as being the type you would wear at a restaurant. I don't know what exactly constitutes restaurant shoes, but the point is that these were not the type of shoes you'd be wearing to go fishing or to be in an area like Myron Grove. Since the shoes were left at the scene, Alicia's grandmother suspected that if these shoes belonged to the killer, maybe he took his shoes off when he put Alicia in the water. It's certainly a viable theory, but then that means he drove off without shoes, and you'd think as soon as he started to drive off, he'd remember his shoes and not want to leave them, but maybe he just left in a panic.
That's a pretty bizarre detail. I would always remember to grab my shoes, you know, wherever I am, because I don't want to run off without shoes, but I don't know. I'm kind of thinking maybe this man, he had his shoes off for a while. Maybe he's the one who performed this heinous act. And maybe he had his shoes off for a long time, forgot that he had his shoes off. I don't know. And then left without his shoes. That just seems weird to me, just to forget your shoes.
I guess after you murder someone, maybe you would be more likely to forget.
Yeah, but maybe you're in a weird state of mind.
Yeah.
Right? Well, and you're not thinking about your shoes because you just did this horrible act. And
yeah. Are you kind of thinking maybe his shoes were already off, like he was fishing? Maybe these are the people who were in the car when Alicia arrived. They were fishing together.
Right.
And then they went in the car. And by the time Alicia arrived, they were in the car. Yeah. Maybe. And his shoes were just left there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a possibility too. Or maybe he just didn't care about his shoes. And I will say the sheriff's department has never commented on the shoes. My thought here is kind of, why don't they release a picture of the shoes and the size? Maybe that could bring in tips from people who recognize them and know someone who wore shoes like that, especially if they drove a dark colored sedan with tinted windows and a loud exhaust. I suppose that could warrant a lot of false leads, especially if they were a common shoe, but maybe it could be one more piece of information to point to a suspect they already have.
I mean, that's kind of related to the object used for the blunt force trauma, right?
Not releasing that. Yeah.
Not releasing that information.
Yeah, but I guess my thinking is with the shoes, it could be more specific. Whereas with a blunt force object, it feels like there are only so many objects there could be to use in a situation like that. So I was just thinking with the shoes, maybe someone could recognize them. Of course, that would not be enough for an arrest, but it just seems like at this point, it's been almost 9 years. There could be something there. This could be a way to generate new attention in the case, but there could be a good reason as to why they haven't done this. In 2021, seemingly out of the blue, law enforcement confirmed that they were in possession of Alicia's cell phone. This entire time, it seemed as though they didn't have it, but it was reportedly found somewhere at the scene at Myron Grove. And maybe it took them a while to find it, but when they found it remains undisclosed. All Sheriff Howe would say was that Alicia's cell phone was discovered during the investigation. And this came as a surprise to Alicia's family and friends, who often hoped her phone would be found one day. The theories in this case branch into two different directions. Either someone who knew Alicia, targeted and killed her, or a stranger killed her. Given the violent nature of Alicia's murder, that might normally align more with a murder where the victim knows their killer. But in this case, this is a very narrow time frame in which Alicia was murdered. She was last known to be alive at 1:45 p.m., and her body was found approximately 30 minutes later. If the killer knew Alicia and targeted her, you can see a situation where maybe the killer was watching Alicia's movements on social media, and once she got to Myron Grove and posted the Snapchat photo, that showed her location, and they hightailed it to get to Myron Grove to commit this murder. And then this would mean that the people Alicia saw having sex in a car would have likely witnessed her murder and chose not to come forward, although I suppose they could have left before her murder. Alicia had no known enemies. In fact, Tony, her ex, would have been the only likely suspect, and his time during Alicia's murder was accounted for. Sheriff Howe contends that there's no evidence to support that Alicia was killed by someone who knew her.
There's only so much research you can do in people's personal lives. We don't know every single person that Alicia had a relationship with. And if she's extremely active, like you said, on social media, then there's probably a lot more people who know her location than we're aware of at this point. So I'm kind of under the assumption that it's more likely that it was someone who knew her.
Yeah, I mean, with her, once she got to Myron Grove, posting on her Snapchat that she was there with the location does open up the door to all of her Snapchat friends as at least knowing where she was at that point in time.
And I'm saying that because it seems like such a personal crime. To me, at least, it doesn't seem like a random person would do this. It seems very personal.
It seems that way. Yes, but that leads us to the second branch here, that someone who was at Myron Grove, who was unknown to Alicia, killed her. The people Alicia saw having sex in a car are suspicious because they've not come forward to say who they are. What if Alicia took a picture of their car, or they thought Alicia was taking pictures of them? That could have upset someone to the point where they attacked her. However, if this is the case, we are talking about a highly dangerous person. I mean, we already were, but if someone taking a picture of them could enrage them to the point of killing someone, that is scary. That's a scary individual, and they are certainly capable of doing something like that again. But the reason this comes to mind is because Alicia was so she was taking pictures of, even when she entered South Dakota, she's taking a picture. So she had a tendency to document her day. So it doesn't seem that far-fetched that she could have started to take a picture of the car and maybe planned to send it to a friend, although no one received a Snapchat of the car.
Yeah, it just seems super unhinged to kill someone over this. Like, you could confront them and say, hey, it looked like you were trying to take a picture of my car when, you know, I was having an intimate moment with this other person. Can you delete that? I don't know if you did, but can you delete that? It seems, and maybe these people were, but it seems extremely unhinged to go to that extent.
It does. And maybe this had nothing to do with the picture. Maybe Alicia saw two people who weren't supposed to be together. You have to think about the type of people who would be out having sex in this area in the middle of the day. But Alicia was a fair distance away from home. So what is the likelihood that she would happen to recognize these people and know that they shouldn't be together? If the two people in the car were behind this and say one of them killed Alicia and the other witnessed it, it's not too late for either of them to come forward, but especially the person who did not physically commit the murder, if they have a conscience at all, that's what they would do. They would share what they know. In my opinion, the theory that the people in the car Alicia saw killed her is the most logical one. So I guess that's where you and I differ here. I think most likely those people in the car at the very least saw something. And at most, they are responsible for Alicia's murder. Another possibility is that someone who was already at Myron Grove, maybe the people in the black car left at that point, if they were the ones driving the black car, and that person who was there wanted to kill someone that day, and Alicia was in the wrong place at the wrong time. A true crime of opportunity. Alicia didn't mention seeing anyone else there other than the people in the car, and you can't see anyone in the photo she took looking out at the water, but the person could have been out of direct view. And here we are almost 9 years later, and Alicia's case remains unsolved. However, I feel optimistic about this case being solved. Sheriff Howe has said that there is a lot of evidence in Alicia's murder, and that's promising, especially if there's DNA evidence. Alicia's family and friends miss her positive and fun-loving nature, and they gather every year to memorialize her. In 2022, they all got together to go fishing to honor her memory. When people think of Alicia, they want them to remember her for how she was when she was alive and not how her life ended. And I think that's important. I probably said this before, but when we discuss these cases, the people we're discussing had entire lives before they met tragedy. And the way their life ended, or presumably ended in a disappearance, is one small, horrible fraction of their life. So we try to balance sharing who the victim was while also telling the story of what happened to them, because the offender very much still needs to be held responsible. And until then, everyone is at risk of being on the receiving end of violence from this killer in this case. Alicia's grandparents are offering a $5,000 reward for any information leading to a conviction in Alicia's case. If you have information, please contact the Clay County Sheriff's Office at 605-677-7100. Thank you all so much for listening today. We won't be back next week, but we will be back on May 5th. Bye.
Bye.